All right, welcome back to a Sunday edition of the Dunked on Basketball podcast. I apologize, those of you who turned in for the 30 in 60 or more, that's coming later this week, probably right before the Thanksgiving holiday. A nice long one for people who are going to travel, but I spent the weekend moving, hopefully into what will soon become a much better place for audio. And Danny, what's up?
Look at you trying to get people's hopes up for better audio quality.
Yeah, and then dash them.
I know. No doubt. You're just so mean.
Yeah. If you are a Bay Area audio engineer, by the way, and you want to help me out with some audio setup for an hour or two and get paid for your time, please send me a message on Twitter. Thanks.
But this was a pretty exciting weekend for games. I mean, we didn't record on Thursday because you did that podcast, a great podcast with Kevin Pelton. And I mean, I would say the biggest story so far is still the Warriors.
Yeah, it is. We were at the game on, the biggest development has been even more that Green at center lineup. That Thursday, they were down 10 with 5 minutes left in the game. They used that to come back and actually win pretty comfortably, as it turned out, in the last minute. Then on Friday, they went to it against the Bulls. I think they outscored the Bulls 11-3 with that lineup. And then they only used it once in this Denver game for like the 2 minutes at the end of the first half. And they scored like 11 points in 2 minutes then. So what are the stats now for that lineup for the season?
Okay, so they are currently, so this is per 100 possessions. They are currently outscoring opponents by 70.8 points per 100 possessions. And that's fueled mostly by a 160.9 offensive rating.
Yeah, that's crazy. It scored, Ethan tweeted this out, 200 points in like 55 minutes or something, 56 minutes?
Yeah, I think it's 56. It's absolutely insane.
It is. And I think it's getting to the point now, too, where it's almost got this placebo effect on the players themselves, because they just know that they're going to kill when they come in, and they also know that they have to play harder to make that lineup work. And so it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy now when they bring that lineup in, that the intensity just gets ratcheted up so high. They know that they're not going to be in for that long altogether. I mean, they usually go to it with 5 minutes left in the fourth quarter. And so you know that you can go extremely hard for 2 minutes, then you get a break at the under three timeout. And then, again, you're going to have tons of timeouts down the stretch as well. So you can play at absolute maximum intensity. I think that's something that has helped that lineup as well.
I agree with you. I think that's a really good point. And it also raises the question of how you would do it differently, you know, like using it more. And the other thing to consider with that is just that using that lineup more, I'm saying a lot more, not a little bit more. They could certainly do that. Almost all of the Warriors' playmakers are involved in that five-man lineup. So what you're doing there is, conceptually, if you used it a lot, you'd be doing a trade-off and basically having a lot of less playable lineups the rest of the time.
Yeah, that's true. And I think there's no reason to bring that lineup out unless you need it, frankly. If you're Luke Walton, maybe in the playoffs, if they get into a point where they're struggling a little bit, we might see them start it again like they did in the Cleveland series. And obviously, if you're playing that unit for more than 5 minutes a game or so, they're not going to be sustainable anyway, but these results are become less sustainable as either guys get tired or you figure them out, or you, as you mentioned, the other combinations start to hurt because those are probably their five best players at the moment.
Yeah. At the same time, though, I think that while the regular season results really only matter in terms of seeding, I think that they'll use it a lot in the playoffs because now it's becoming more and more clear that it's their best lineup. And so I think that you can do it a little bit differently, both because of the way that rest works and because, of course, the importance of games ratchets up.
Yeah, and you remember last Saturday, Luke Walton didn't go to that lineup because they had Brook Lopez in the game. And then he only went to it at the very end against Toronto. And then, they took Valanciunas out immediately. So hopefully he will just be smart enough now to say, hey, this is the best lineup in the NBA. I don't care who you have on the floor. You want to leave Brook Lopez out there? Fine, match up with us defensively, and we can have Draymond Green guard him and double. That's what's so awesome about that lineup is they can just double team. It's probably one of the best lineups in NBA history for double teaming the post. And we've seen that, for example, when they went to Pau Gasol or they tried to ISO Jimmy Butler against the Bulls, they were able to get a quick double team. And those guys, Iguodala, Green, those guys are so smart about double teaming too. Curry's another one of those guys as well, just have amazing instincts that they can just, when the guy turns his back, they'll go. When they know that there's no one to pass it to, they'll go. And they're just so good on both ends. It's remarkable.
Yeah, it's a truly special lineup. And I think that there's an interesting piece by Jonathan Charks about it. And there aren't a whole lot of natural intuitive counters to it.
No, that's true. I've had a couple of things kind of banging around my brain about how I would try to defend that lineup. And obviously the crux of it is that Green Curry pick and roll, which people think, all right, what we have to do is we're going to put a smaller guy, not our center, on Green. The Bulls had Gasol guarding Iguodala. I thought they should have gone with Gibson and Mirotić as the front court, which actually might have been okay defensively, about as good as you can hope against those guys. But they went with Gasol. So then what ended up happening was they switched it. They had the point guard on Green, and Green got a bucket and then found Harrison Barnes for a three, posting up. So it was, and that's something that he's really worked on throughout the course of the year. I think ultimately probably the guy I would want to beat me still is Andre, but make him beat you in a way that's not just a wide open corner three, obviously. I think I would go with the point guard on Andre and put whoever my best wing defender is on Steph and say, and maybe even not switch, try not switching and see how that works. Just have the guy try to help and then recover back a little bit and see how that goes. I mean, that's just one thought. I don't know that would work, but I think teams have been switching so much now that if you just put the absolute best guy you can, a Kawhi Leonard type of guy, a KCP type, and say, all right, you know, you need to get over the screen, bother Steph's shot from behind, and just try to get back to him as quickly as you can, you know, instead of just giving up or still having your point guard guarding Steph. And then when you get the switch, you have that guy in the post. You want to have like the two most like-sized guys guarding Green and Steph if you do have to switch. So I don't know. That doesn't sound like any kind of a panacea, I'm sure. And we've talked about it before. But what are some of the teams that might even be able to stand a chance against this lineup among the contenders? I think we can toss out the Clippers, despite Doc saying he thinks they match up well with that small lineup. That clearly is not the case in both of the regular season games. They've gotten completely smoked at the end of games by that lineup. Who else is there?
I mean, the Spurs are the prototype for this because they have two elite perimeter defenders that you could theoretically either hold firm or switch in Danny Green and Kawhi. Like, I think that that's a way to do it. One thing that I was thinking about with it is that the lack of a clear, just unstoppable post player makes it even harder. Like, if Shaq was, prime Shaq was in existence now, you could exploit something like that. But now there really aren't those guys in the league right now, because that's the other way that you could do it, is if you could get a guy that's so good that he'll draw fouls or doubles. I think that Oklahoma City, it gets close, but they don't really have the defensive talent. For them, it would just be like,
can I interrupt you for a second? Sure. with that Shaq? And so, you know, Bob Vulgaris tweeted, this is the best lineup I've ever seen during the Clippers game. And part of that was just based on the fact that players are better now than they were back then. You know, maybe not the best lineup ever relative to the league. But it is an interesting point. You know, if they had a Shaq or some post behemoth, what do you think is going to do better? Putting Shaq in a pick and roll, guarding Curry way out on the floor versus Shaq posting up and you got to double him?
Well, you wouldn't have Shaq in the Curry Draymond pick and roll. You couldn't do that. You'd have to have him somewhere else.
All right. Well, I mean, they're going to put whoever Shaq's guarding in the pick and roll, whether it's Andre, whether it's Harrison, whether
it's Draymond. I think that's, there's a point.
I mean, that's what, you know, Memphis tried that, putting Z-Bo on Barnes. And first of all, Barnes blew past Z-Bo whenever, right? I mean, cause that's part of the problem. You put it in the pick and roll. Barnes may not be have like a ton of pick and roll chemistry, but all you got to do is just have him set the screen and kind of just run out to somewhere else in the 3-point line, once he catches the ball, there's no way that big is getting back in front of him. He can drive right to the basket at that point. I mean, you know, you saw what Barnes was able to do to Zebo in that Memphis series last year. So that's, I mean, the people who say, oh, the answer is just bludgeon them down low. And John Tarks talked about this in that piece you mentioned. You know, I don't think that's it, because I think this team is so good at doubling, so good at helping and recovering, so good at getting into the passing lanes. Yeah, I mean, you're at a little bit of a disadvantage if you have to double team, obviously. Also, so good at pressuring the ball to even prevent the pass into the post to begin with. And then also, you know, I think when you look at the fact that they have Curry is a plus rebounder for his position, Clay isn't that good, but Andre's a good rebounder, Barnes is a good rebounder, Green is. You have enough rebounding that lineup historically has not gotten killed on the offensive glass, especially when they're playing at this manic intensity and everyone is tracking back onto the glass. So it's just really, really hard to beat that lineup. Even if you have the post-up behemoths, I think your hope is that you maybe have like one AD type of guy who is big enough. But even he is not like that guy. Anyone who's mobile enough to stay with them on the perimeter is someone that Green's going to be able to guard in the post just fine.
Yeah, I mean, the only exception would be like 2 years from now, Karl Anthony Towns. But we don't have that, and they're not going to be a playoff team, so they don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, and that's something that John talked about as well. Enough on this lineup. I mean, did you have any thoughts at all on the game in particular?
On the Bulls game? Well, I guess
this Denver game, since we are theoretically talking about that, but the Bulls game too. I mean, these last three, even the Clippers games, we haven't been on in a while. These have all been some interesting Warriors games lately.
I think that what's been notable to me about this little run and towards mid November is that all in all, I don't think the Warriors, like from top to bottom, have played as strong games as they have, you know, like earlier in the run when they were just demolishing teams. But I don't also think that they needed that. And they, you know, they've dealt with some weird injuries, like Livingston missed some games, Bogut has had his share of things, but they still have only, they've been threatened in this 15-0 run. I think they've been really what I would consider threatened three times, and one of those was a Raptors game where I believe the Raptors never led, like they just got really close. And that is really impressive to me. And, you know, the Nuggets game, they, you know, they danced around it a little bit, but like basically it ended up being the backups that closed it out.
Yeah, that's true. And that was encouraging for them. I mean, this Nuggets team, I feel badly because I actually really admire the job that Mike Malone has been able to do with them. They are missing their top three bigs this game with Fareed out, Nurkic being out as well. Wilson Chandler as well has been out. LaVerne has been out as well. So, I mean, and Chandler's out for the year. So it's really hard. I thought Gary Harris actually did a pretty good job on Steph in this game.
Sure.
And Moutier has looked pretty decent defensively as well. He started off hot, but then ended up falling apart on just taking a bunch of bad mid-range jumpers that just kind of bricked off the side of the rim. You know, didn't look too good. I think he'll get better. So this was not a huge challenge. You know, I think Golden State would have been disappointed to win by any less than they did. I still think the defense needs a little work for them, though, huh?
Yeah, especially the starters. I mean, they had that stretch, I think it was in the second quarter, where they just looked lethargic. And I think part of that is Bogut doesn't seem like he's all the way back all the time now. He's had these flashes. I think there was a little nice stretch he had of like 4 or 5 minutes against the Bulls. Might have been second quarter, might have been third quarter, where he looked really good. But other than that, he seemed a little bit out of sorts.
Yeah, defensively he does, and the quintessential play on that, although there have been plenty of others, is how he kind of just got dunked around. Now, it wasn't even on, it was around, because he didn't get there by Gallinari, and I think we've kind of forgotten in all the hubbub about this Warriors season that Bogut first suffered a broken nose when he was actually defending at the rim when KJ McDaniels followed through on a dunk in the preseason and cracked his nose, and then, you know, he missed 2 weeks, and then he had the concussion in the first game of the year against New Orleans, and he missed, I think, 6 games from that. So I think his conditioning isn't there. He looks good physically, you know, in terms of his speed, but he might be, you know, for lack of a better term, a little bit gun shy, sticking his nose in there, getting his body in front of guys. You know, that's sort of a way he's injured himself in the past. I think he injured his ribs in a similar circumstance. So he's definitely a rough and tumble guy, and I think he's got to kind of get his confidence back to be able to do that. because he's not doing the job protecting the rim the way he has in past seasons right now.
Yeah, and it's weird. Ethan Sherwood-Strauss talked about this a little bit during the game, that the starting five, the group with Bogut at center, actually hasn't done that well statistically for a team that's 15-0. And you know,
yeah, so, Azealia is a better player than Bogut right now. I think there's no two ways about that.
Yeah, and I mean, I agree with you. We've talked about this before, that Bogut is a much better fit with the first unit than the second unit, but I think that they need to be more open to commingling that a little bit, just because when Azealia is playing better, then, you know, maybe in the second quarter you do that, just to try to get the balance right, especially if you're going to play Draymond at center for, you know, for even a couple minutes, just to balance it out a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. All right, let's move on to some of the other games. Golden State's vanquished foes from that game on Thursday, the Clippers, have now lost two more games, and they're not looking good at all. You know, I know Paul has missed time. He has been back now. He came back earlier than expected for that Golden State game, had that unbelievable first half against the Warriors. But after that, he's had two kind of bad games in a row. You have to wonder whether, you know, he's still kind of bothered with that groin. I mean, that can happen when you come back from that sort of muscle injury too soon, is, you know, you feel fine during the game and then it swells up and it gets stiff afterwards. So, you know, he's had two bad games in a row. Overall in the season, only a 1.1 net rating with Chris Paul on the floor, 0.8 with Blake Griffin on the floor. And usually you could say, all right, the Clippers' problem is their bench isn't doing well enough. But if they're not doing well with those two guys on the floor, that is not a good indication of their health.
It isn't, and there's the concern that they don't really have a good option for the fifth guy, and that matters both at the end of games. They've had a lot of trouble.
Well, I think the problem is with Redick out, they don't even have a good option for the fourth guy right
now. That's true, too. And even if you put Jamal up there, then that creates a vacuum in the second unit. And yeah, there are a lot of kind of concerning things. What I wrote in the original 30 for 60 plan, and the question of, is it time to panic for me with them? But the answer to that is really, if you thought of them as a championship contender, I think the answer is yes, because there it seems like there are structural deficiencies. However, I'm still comfortable saying they're a playoff team.
Oh, yeah, I'm certainly comfortable with that. I don't know if it is time to panic. I mean, look at the two games that they've played against the Warriors. They've played them close when they've been at peak. I think if Redick comes back and they're still struggling, then I'll start worrying, because they really, really need his shooting, and he's at least a guy who's going to compete and execute. I think Pierce is too slow at this point. They have a negative 5.3 net rating with him on the floor. Granted, it's early on, but you know, he hasn't looked good. He doesn't look like a guy who can stay on the floor against a team like Golden State due to his quickness. Redick is the one guy. I think he has a 3.9 net rating, and DJ is in the threes. Those are the only two of them that are doing pretty well. But yeah, I mean, I think you do have to worry. Like the Toronto game, they couldn't score at all against what's a good Toronto defense, especially with Valanciunas out. But Blake got destroyed by Luis Scola, who had like 20 points, and Blake, you know, had like 11 points. I mean, Luis Scola is someone that he should be able to absolutely dominate, and you know, he just wasn't able to do it in this game.
Yeah, it's, I have trouble kind of piecing together, reconciling how they played the two best games that anybody has played against the Warriors, and yet they have games like that one. And then they, you know, they're one of the kind of few teams that's lost to the Rockets, and, you know, they lost to the Suns. And so this is a team that, they lost the Suns without Chris Paul, I believe. So that obviously mitigates some of that. But they're still a very talented team. I mean, when you have a top four, when they're healthy, as good as their four, you should be relevant. But I also don't know a clear-cut way to have an answer, because they also don't have a ton of assets to move in terms of solving their problems.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's been the case for quite a while. And I'm not trying to kill Doc for his offseason, although you know who they could really use right now?
Matt Barnes.
That's right. I mean, not that Barnes has been any great shakes either, but he at least was a guy who could shoot open threes. He had a good knack for cutting with the starters to the basket, and was not a sieve defensively. I mean, he was part of a starting lineup that was unstoppable, and now they haven't been that good with his departure. I mean, I can't say that any of the guys that they brought in is giving them anywhere close to what he did last year.
And I was hopeful that there, whether it was the integration of the guys that they added, you know, Josh Smith for the minimum and Lance and all that, that in, whether it was integrating those guys with the four we talked about or whether it was as a second unit, I'm like, well, they can't be worse than last year. And I think that's true. I haven't looked at the non, you know, the bench units, the true hockey subs with this team, but they don't have enough now outside of that to beat teams regularly. And I mean, today they were getting demolished at halftime. They were down more than 30 at halftime and they ended up bringing it back. And certainly there's something to be said for that. I mean, when I think they got it to 7, I think that was as close as I saw it watching the fourth quarter, but you know, it was a home game against the Raptors, and the Raptors are not a bad team by any stretch of the imagination. They're another pretty close to definite playoff team, but you shouldn't be down 30 at home to the team at halftime.
Yeah, no, that's certainly true. I mean, they only scored 11 points in that second quarter. And this is shifting to the Raptors. They've been on this road trip for like 2 weeks now, playing a ton of tough Western teams. And they've done really well to stay afloat. I've been very impressed with their performance. Now Valanciunas is going to be out for 6 weeks with a fractured fourth metacarpal on his left hand. He's not going to get surgery. He's just going to rehab it. But I think I'm very interested to see what this team's defense looks like with more Biombo, because Biombo, for all of his hopelessness on the offensive end, is a fantastic defensive player. He really intimidates just about everything at the rim. And I think this team could be extremely difficult to score against, with him in there as well. So, yeah, it's, the Toronto team and Scola has been playing out of his mind. I mean, that can't continue. You wonder where now with Biombo, another zero offensively, where the offense is going to come from. Jamari Carroll saved them today. He has 21 points on 15 shooting possessions, 4 steals again. He's just been everything they could have ever hoped for, really having a spectacular season so far and solving some of their problems on the wing. Terrence Ross is back too, which in theory could help them, although he was 0 for 3 in 16 minutes tonight.
Yeah, this road trip was kind of remarkable for me in the sense that their 3 losses were all quite impressive. I mean, they lost pretty close to the Warriors. The Kings game was a little bit worse, and then they lost by, I think it was 5 against the Jazz, and then they swept the LA teams. But, like, that's a really good road trip. And also now they don't have to play any of those teams on the road anymore.
Yeah. So, you know where Terrence Ross will not be starting for anyone?
Nice segue.
That would be in your lineup at DraftKings.com. Basketball is back, and you can be part of the action all season long at DraftKings, the destination for daily fantasy basketball. Over $500 million in prizes are being paid out this season. And the best part about daily fantasy is it's not like you have to spend months micromanaging a roster, finding out who's playing. Your matchup that week depends on how many games your star plays. No, I mean, obviously, it's not practical. Even for us, this is our jobs. To watch basketball and be totally on top of things every single day. You need a night off. You're better off just doing DraftKings. Focus in on the matchups at night. Watch the games. Really enjoy yourself. Also, if you are using the other leading brand, which the unmentionable other leading brand, you're offered more lineup flexibility and also the ability to sub in guys for the late games. Your lineup locks a lot later. So even if you're using the other leading brand, try switching to DraftKings. You can use the Capspace code to play for free in your first contest. And you can also help support the podcast by doing that. That's Capspace, all one word, only at DraftKings.com. All right, what we got next?
Do you want to go Thunder Mavericks?
I do.
That was a really interesting game.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I think one of my big takeaways here is this is another game that OKC should have lost. And they were lucky that the Mavericks went a mere 16 out of 28 from the free throw line. Because, and OKC's defense is still broken. And you can say that Kevin Durant, helps with that a little bit. But, I don't think he's some game changer on the defensive end. I mean, this team just has to get better defensively if they want to get to where they're going to be.
That said, mostly Serge Ibaka holding Dirk to only 7 field goal attempts is awfully impressive.
Yeah, it is. And Ibaka, you think back to 4 years ago in the 2011 Western Conference Finals, when they're sort of at different points in their career trajectories, Dirk just destroyed Ibaka one-on-one. And now Dirk doesn't quite have the strength of the explosion to get his shot off one-on-one and use, you know, he had all the tricks back then, but he also had enough athleticism to make those work. Now if he's, you know, Ibaka does a great job at getting back to him in pick and roll. And you know, Dirk obviously is always going to open things up for his teammates. And Deron Williams had his second straight really nice game. But yeah, aside from Ibaka and Robertson, who doesn't play that much, like who can you trust to really defend on this team? Maybe it's Steven Adams, but still, you know, I think Donovan just frankly is not getting as much out of the defensive talent as Scott Brooks was able to, maybe not last year, but in previous years.
And in this game, Russell Westbrook had a bunch of steals. I think he ended up with five. He had three, and I think he had three in the first 5 minutes. It was kind of insane where he had that. But despite that, you'd say, oh, if Russell Westbrook did that, then maybe Deron Williams struggled. But Deron had a good game.
Yeah, he did. Despite taking two terrible quick twos at the end of the game when they were down three both times. I mean, one of them was, I think, an 18-foot fadeaway over Ibaka. And then the other one was an attempt to drive on Ibaka off of a switch when he had, I think it was Waiters guarding, oh no, I'm sorry, it was Westbrook guarding Dirk, but it was in the corner. Westbrook had helped off a little bit. He had a chance to get it to Dirk for what might have been a tough shot, but Dirk can, you know, get his shot off over Russell Westbrook on a closeout to tie the game. Instead, he drove and got it blocked away. And then Wes Matthews made an ill-advised attempt to draw a foul on a three-pointer that looked ridiculous, and Oklahoma City ended up escaping. But D-Will, aside from that, he was getting to the basket more. He had some nice finishes over Steven Adams, and he's shooting a better percentage at the rim. Still pretty bad, only 52%, but that's a lot better than the 40% that he shot last year. And with that, I think he's back to being, you know, not a star certainly, but an effective player.
And speaking of being back, what do you think about Chandler Parsons so far? I think he's getting there, but he's not there yet.
Yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, you look at his stats, he had another nice game. He was up to 24 minutes now. Hasn't been closing these games, I think in part due to the minutes limit. But I think we can get to the point now, if he's going to be up to 24 minutes, where he can start doing that relatively soon. And he doesn't have the explosion off of 1 foot quite yet that he did in, you know, defensively, I think he's going to struggle to get back into it. And he's never been an amazing defender, but yeah, I think he's on track. He's looking better than I ever thought. And same thing with Wes.
We also, I feel the need to mention that JaVale McGee came back, and it was a total McGee performance where his box score stats were Where his box score stats were good. He had 8 and 6 and had a couple dunks but he was minus 15.
Yeah, 4 or 5 from the field.
In 10 minutes.
Yeah, and Cantor, who corresponded with him, was plus 10. Also, another note for this game, Anthony Morrow got 24 minutes, which is the most of the OKC subs. That's actually, I think, something that we should start seeing more of. And more of Morrow. And he had a good performance in the box score and plus minus. He just opens things up so much. I mean, if this team's not going to defend anyway, you might as well just bring out your best offensive lineup.
Agreed. And I think Morrow has a bona fide skill, which is that he can drill open shots. And that especially when you don't have Kevin Durant, there is a value to that. And I've been caping, if you want to call it that, for him to get more minutes, just because, not because he's the greatest player in the world, but because he does something that teams have to pay attention to. And I think that that's always nice, especially when Durant's not on the floor.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of the greatest open shooters in NBA history. I mean, he's just reliably well over 40% on threes every year. Let's get to New Orleans Phoenix now. This New Orleans now is, I think, 3-11. KP and I wrote them out of the playoffs when they were 1-11 back on Thursday. And part of my reasoning was there's no guarantee even that they were going to start playing well now. I thought that they still had further down to go. Then they beat the Spurs pretty handily, actually, in a game that Popovich actually gave up the last 3 minutes. And then this game against Phoenix, you know, they didn't kill them, but Phoenix has been playing reasonably well. So it's a decent home win. Now at 3-11, I mean, you know, when we made that prediction, we didn't have them necessarily winning these two games. Do you agree with us that they have no chance of getting back to the playoffs, or were we too hasty in writing them off?
I think that you were a little hasty, but not super hasty. I mean, the thing to remember is that, yes, they do have players to come back, but they have to be healthy.
Danny the Ent says that we were too hasty in...
That's a reference I don't
in
know.
In writing them off. No, Lord of the Rings? Ents?
I know Ents exist, but...
Yeah, there's always... Treebeard is always complaining that, like, the hobbits are doing things too hastily. Anyway.
So I think that what the Pelicans need is to be relatively healthy the rest of the way, and there are no guarantees of that. So I think one of the things that really helps them is that the bottom of the West is not really putting too much distance right now. I mean, granted, they're still really far behind, and they're going to have to play incredibly well to do it. I mean, they're going to have to be substantially better than they were on the aggregate last year. But they've shown the last couple of games that that's in them. I mean, one of the huge developments with them is that Ryan Anderson is playing better than he has the last couple of years.
He's averaging 19 a game, and he's had some monster games these last couple. He and AD have been screening for each other a lot, and that is, with the way those guys can both shoot, if you're guarding them each with a big, you damn well better switch that, because bigs are not going to get out to either of those guys 20 feet from the basket, or even with Anderson more often at the three-point line, and even AD can take that too. So they're able to get a lot of nice shots off of that kind of action, and they did against in the Suns game. And they've desperately needed Anderson scoring. They've also been switching a ton defensively, even with Anderson. And they've also been going more with something that I had advocated, which is Dante Cunningham playing the four. And that also allows for switching. Omer Asik only played 15 minutes tonight, and then Ajinsa didn't play at all. So they only had 15 minutes with a traditional center on the floor. And I think ultimately that's what Alvin Gentry would like to do in his soul. And that's kind of makes the Ajinsa and Asik signings a little weird, considering who your coach was that you had coming in. But nonetheless, I think he's starting to find something a little bit more towards a way that he's comfortable coaching. They just need to get these record scratch guys like Ish Smith, and who actually has been great for Ish Smith, but he can't play off the ball at all. And Alonzo G, if they can turn those guys' record scratches into open threes, then they're going to really have something offensively, I think.
And you talked about how Asik and Ajinsa only played 15 minutes combined in this game. And so you think, oh, maybe that's a one-game aberration. But against the Spurs, another game they won, they combined for 22. It was just split 11 and 11 as opposed to 15 and 0.
Yeah, that's right. And, I think AD looked better defensively as well. He had some nice intimidations, especially down the stretch. Because guys feel him and are aware of him. If he actually can just get there and be a presence, that makes such a huge difference. Phoenix, for their part, they also went very, very little with Tyson Chandler with the traditional big. It was more Markieff and Teletovic. They went a little bit with PJ Tucker at the four as well. So it was not a game that we saw much from traditional bigs at all.
Yeah, there was a fun stretch in, I think it was in their previous game, where they were playing Warren at the four, the two point guards, and Booker. And I think they were doing it with Lure at center, which I thought was just going a little bit too far in that direction. But I like that Hornacek is really trying those things, especially getting Devin Booker out on the four, because I think while he has his flaws, he's been a really nice offensive player for them.
Yeah, he has. He had 15 points in 16 minutes. And one of the things that I was really impressed by is he already is able to leverage his shot on closeouts or even in pick and roll to get to the basket. He actually, Drew Holiday was guarding him, and he was able to burn Drew to the bucket a couple of times. And his shot is really pure. He's been compared to Klay Thompson. I would say that he is ahead of Thompson, and also I think 3 years younger than Thompson when he was drafted. But he's ahead of Thompson as a rookie in terms of his ability to get to the basket, make plays off the dribble, make cuts. He had a couple of nice plays on flex cuts as well, where you kind of, a lot of teams will run flex now where you have the option to either come across the lane, which they rarely do, or get a down screen out to the top. And so he actually came across the lane. He was being guarded, I think, by Ish Smith, who was too big for him, and he just scored on him. So I've been very impressed by him. The knock on him coming out of school is that he wasn't athletic enough, but he looks like a totally average NBA shooting guard. And with his stroke, that means that he can really be something. I mean, he still makes plenty of rookie defensive mistakes, but Phoenix has got to be very happy with what they have in him right now.
Yeah, they have to be thrilled. And what I like about it is that he already has something that he does well and the teams have to pay attention to. And what I've been really impressed with, kind of like a couple of guys in this rookie class, is that the downsides aren't as steep as I expected them to be. And I think that's part of how this class has made such an early contribution, is that they aren't killing you, particularly on the defensive end, like we always assume rookies will.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to talk about this because there are two points that have come out of how well everyone has been playing. I mean, Porzingis had another awesome game. Towns has been fantastic. Okafor, you know, has struggled, but he's in a pretty weird ecosystem in Philly. I think he's been everything that everyone has hoped, at least from a scoring standpoint. Winslow has been fantastic. Stanley Johnson has shown some signs. Booker has looked good. Rondae Hollis Jefferson has really helped the Nets a lot to get back to respectability. Once he came into the starting lineup, that was that really helped them. You noted that their starting lineup with him in it has been playing pretty well. I mean, all these guys have just been fantastic. So, and even Russell hasn't been that bad. I mean, he's just kind of not living up to expectations compared to some of the other guys that they could have drafted. Cauley Stein has been solid as well. And so the first thing I thought is, you know, people always say, all right, AAU basketball is ruining everything. Our development system is so screwed up. You know, all these guys are like freshmen, right? Like coming in. And I mean, obviously Porzingis is not from here. Moutier also has looked good. All these guys developed through that system and they look fantastic. So, you know, Kobe said that AAU basketball is killing us. Well, those products of AAU basketball are killing him now.
And it's not like a lot of those guys really got ingrained in the college system. Like, I don't think you can give Coach K credit for Justice Winslow being the defender that he's been so far.
Yeah, and if there were some, like, crazy structure, would Karl Towns have, like, the skill level that he has right now? I mean, his coaches at the youth level deserve a ton of credit for allowing him to develop that kind of a skill set as a big guy. Same thing with Porzingis over in Europe to develop his shooting stroke. So it's really, and, you know, those guys play a lot of pick and roll. They try to spread the floor as much as they can. I think they still play too many games, which is not great for guys. To be going in a different city every weekend during the summer is like a little ridiculous, even if you're a young kid. But yeah, I don't think that there are that many problems, frankly, with the development system right now. And when you talk to people from Europe, they complain that their own system is too rigid and the guys don't develop the individual creativity the way they do here.
Yeah, it's always a hard balance to strike, and It does seem like an aberration with this class, but it's a wonderful aberration.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the next point that I wanted to get to is, remember when the 2014 class was the greatest thing ever and the 2015 class was supposed to be meh?
Yeah, I think that a lot of that also goes to people being obsessed with the top of a class as opposed to the depth of it, too.
Well, I mean, this has been the top of the class, right? I mean, how much, think of how much hype. And Wiggins has been great, don't get me wrong. But how much hype did he get compared to Karl Towns when he was in high school, right? And my point is, I think once you get around to draft time, and certainly the 2014 class has been really hurt by injuries, once you get around to draft time, maybe you can start to say we have an idea, but you still don't have a great idea of what's a great draft, right? Like 2008 and 2009 were supposed to be terrible drafts, and 2007 was supposed to be awesome. And 08 and 09 were way better than 2007. I mean, there's only one superstar who came out of 07 and then maybe another real, you know, two other real good players in Horford and Conley, off the top of my head, at least that were drafted high up. And then 08 and 09 both had, you know, three, four superstars in the top 10. So, and not guys who people thought necessarily were going to be those superstars.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a great point, and that's also why you don't necessarily want to, you know, why you don't want to move picks way too far ahead of time thinking that a draft class is weak.
Yeah, I think that's true too, right? Especially, like, if you can say right now we know whether a draft is going to be good or bad or not, this 2016 draft, no way. Like, I think you're almost just throwing darts at a dartboard at this point to be saying that.
Yeah, you can't say it definitively. I mean, you can say, like, it looks, at this point, it looks to be like that. But, yeah, I mean, anybody who makes those big moves right now. And also, we're at the point now where what changes this calculus is that these are young guys that are contributing early. And when you think about where the rookie scale is relative to the cap and where it'll be for the next couple of years, these guys, like, if we were going to do a conceptual, whether you call it a trade value column or a fantasy draft column, these guys rocket up the list because not only do you have them on real cost control for a couple of years, but you have team control after that.
Yeah, I'm going to be writing my annual top prospects in the NBA piece in 2-3 weeks here, and I'm really looking forward to going through the analysis and seeing where some of these new guys fit in there. That's going to be a fun exercise.
Just for fun, where do you draw the line on that? Is it age?
Yeah, so it's – I do it like if a player is going to – turn 24 by February 1st, so just sort of the age if he's in his age 24 season, that's too old. And I think like 23 is good because back in the day when guys would play 4 years, you know, I think that you can still consider yourself a prospect if you would have been 1 year out of college. And 23 is sort of the youngest age where you can say, and think of it, he's only 23 years old or he's only 20 years old or whatever. And have that actually mean something where you really feel like there's a lot more ceiling to explore. I think once you get to 24, it's like, all right, you know, there are some exceptions, but generally in the aging curve, you know, unless the guy's Jimmy Butler, you're pretty close to what you're going to be. I mean, guys' primes are basically 25 to 29 in the NBA. So that's why I draw it at 23.
Okay. Good.
Yeah. And we'll certainly do a podcast on that once I come out with the article as well, so that'll be redundant, but that's all right. There'll be a lot more to talk about on the podcast. All right, should we do Lakers and the Blazers. Guys that Portland, Kobe Bryant missed 18 out of, or I'm sorry, missed 16 out of 22 shots against the Portland Trail Blazers?
Yeah, it's always troublesome when you have more shots than points and you still go and you go 6-for-7 from the line.
Well, you know, yeah, you know what happened though was he started off hot, right? Like he got fouled a couple times, hit a couple of fadeaways, got one layup, which was a miracle. And I was a little bit behind, but because I was catching up on DVR. But I was thinking at the time, oh, this is just the absolute best thing that the Blazers could have asked for. And ultimately, he ended up taking 25 shooting possessions in 31 minutes. And scoring, I guess it was 17 points, I think. Either 17 or 18 points, something like that. So, you know, not even, I mean, and even as many shots as shooting possessions, you know, a 50 true shooting percentage, that's still below average. Like you need to have, or I'm sorry, as many points as shooting possessions. So you need to have more points than shooting possessions to be efficient, really. And, you know, I mean, how many, has he even had one game like that this year? Maybe. Like,
maybe yeah. One. We could start playing that game of like making sure we make a point on the podcast when he has one.
Well, and it's just he can't get good shots. It's completely insane. Every shot is a fadeaway. I mean, he took like 3 shots within 8 feet, or 4 shots within 8 feet, and made, you know, 2 or 3 of them. And then everything else was just a terrible mid range. He's 0-for-5 on threes, and I just. You know, I guess you just have to sort of grin and bear it if you're a Lakers fan and hope that he plays so badly that he retires because he can't deal with playing like this anymore.
And I wonder if it gives the Lakers front office or whoever the confidence to tell him either no or you can only come back in a reduced role if he decides to come back. Because
I think he did say that unless something changes, he was probably leaning against coming back. And I would imagine that the thing that would have to change would be his performance. And I don't think any of us expect his performance to change much at this point.
Yeah, and also, as you noted in the notes, and I think is a good point, is that the Blazers are a particularly terrible matchup for this Lakers team. I mean, Damian Lillard, I think he tied his career high for assists and also scored 30 points.
Yeah, and McCollum had 19 points on, I think, only 13 shots. So, yeah, I mean, with Kobe, Russell as a rookie, Clarkson and Russell should eventually get to where they could be okay defensively, but they don't, I mean, especially in this Lakers system, they're not going to be able to defend at all. I will say this though. I think that Roy Hibbert still has something left. And I actually have been, I've been impressed by his mobility. I mean, he actually even like put the ball on the floor and like kind of sort of drove past someone and then threw a pass in this game. You know, it's just obviously he's got too much to do at the rim. He's only one man, unless, you know, even if you're Anthony Davis, can only do so much, and Hibbert doesn't have that level of mobility. But I think he can really help the team still and still be the foundation of a pretty good defense. And maybe, you know, it's too early for this, but maybe we can talk about whether there's a team that might want to trade for him at some point, especially as the Lakers, I mean, they're, what, 2-11 now? So we assume that they're not going to get, you know, the number one seed in the lottery. That's going to be Philly, the way they're playing. Although Philly could start playing better. You know, it could still be the Lakers. So if they, but assume they don't get the number one seed, what's the best chance they could have of retaining that top three protected?
I think it's 55.8. I tweeted it out during the weekend as I watched the Sixers implode during the fourth quarter of that game against the Heat. And, you know, and what we've talked about before on this is that the challenge for the Lakers is that if you're in that range, the incentive to tank is very low just because you can't make your odds that much better. I mean, 10% about, I think I kind of have a rough estimate in my head of it's about 10% per slot in the early slots. And then it becomes less in, as you get further down for obvious reasons. But yeah, the Lakers, what they need to kind of figure out with that is any guys that aren't a part of their future that any team considers an asset, I feel like you have to just be on the phones constantly with those guys, because you're in a situation not only with the pick that they owe now to the Sixers, originally to the Suns, but with their other, just with everything that they have, they need to try to take, even if it's a small asset, out of everything, because any roster spot that you can get, you know, if you can get a capable guy for the minimum or close to it, that just opens up space for you to use your cap on less guys, and that's great for them.
By the way, Jordan Clarkson is having a pretty nice year. The one thing he hasn't done is get to the line at all. Mm-hmm. But he's shooting 46% on threes, only 46 attempts, but a decent number.
Yeah.
You know, only averaging 2 turnovers a game. That's not too bad. And he's certainly a million times more efficient than Bryant. And yet, you know, Bryant takes way more shots than him. And you know, it's just, all right, we beat this horse. It's
dead. The only thing I'll say, what I've seen so far with Clarkson is I think he'd be a really nice fit as a third guard, as, you know, a guy who can kind of toe a couple different lines, but really challenging to see where his number comes in, because he is in that he's going to be a restricted free agent.
Oh, I would absolutely max him out, and I'm maxing him out because he's a second year guy. Exactly. But I mean, I would go 4 years even. So basically, the way his contract would work, this is an estimate. I haven't looked at it in a second. I wrote a piece on it a little bit. He is a very low cap hold, which will help the Lakers, and they can also match anything. But if I were another team, he's basically limited to the mid-level exception his first year, because it's under the arenas rule. If you have two or less years of experience, then you're limited, even in a max offer, to the mid-level exception your first year, mid-level exception plus a 4.5% raise your second year. But then the third and fourth year can go up to the max, but it's not the max. It's what the max would have been plus the raises. So let's say you pretend you got the max the first year, then you get 4.5% raises. That's what year three and four are. So year three and four would end up being like 23, 24 million or so. And his full contract would end up averaging, I think, would be about 4 years, 60 million or so. And so
then
it's basically
there's
$15 million.
The averaging part of it too.
Yeah, and the weird thing about that, and this actually could help the Lakers, is he could, if he goes on to the new team, his cap number gets averaged across those 4 years, so it's $15 million. If he stays on the Lakers and they match, his cap number is what his actual salary is, so it's the $5 million or so, I guess closer to $6 million now is the MLE the first year. And then if they want to do something in free agency in 2017, again, his cap number will still only be about $6 million. That's much better than if it's averaged out. You actually have a way, by having him sign an offer sheet elsewhere, to make him cheaper in 2017. So there's a little bit of an advantage there. But the other thing they might do is they can always just agree on whatever contract they want with him. They'll just have to use some cap space to do it. So they'll probably want to wait until after they do all their other business. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. But, yeah, I mean, for a guy like him who's young, has some promise, weak point guard market, $15 million a year is average starter money, I'll take a gamble on him. I mean, what else are you going to do with your money if you're some of these kind of also-ran teams? I mean, Philly should absolutely throw him a max offer sheet. They have nothing in the backcourt right now.
Yeah, I definitely think there's something to be said for that. And
he's young enough to grow with a rebuilding team.
And if you're the Lakers, I would honestly seriously consider letting him sign an offer sheet with somebody like that just because of that strategic benefit. Yes, you lose.
Yeah.
You do that. And also then you don't have the same downside risk that the Rockets ended up having with Jeremy Lin, which was that you're trying to unload that last year where the player is making a whole heck of a lot more than their listed salary. So teams were reticent to take on that extra, I think, was like $8 million. And so if you match on Clarkson, then what you see is what you get on those features. So if you get, you know, Russell Westbrook or whoever in free agency, then you don't have to deal with a team who's like, oh, well, I don't want to pay, you know, this extra money that you guys offered him.
Yeah, the only downside to that is that they could end up getting a shorter deal that they have to match or a deal with a player option. So they might have them locked up for less time. So that's a little bit of a concern. But all right, we got any news to get to before we go here?
Well, so we talked about Valanciunas. The other two bigger pieces are Marcus Smart is out for 2 weeks with a left leg injury. And you're not going to hear me say the name of the injury because I'll probably mess up the pronunciation. I don't want to feel stupid. He banged knees with Thomas Robinson. So I think what I heard is it's about 2 weeks.
Okay. Yeah, and then Mozgov has a strained deltoid, which is like the shoulder muscle that you use to kind of push stuff with your shoulder. So he's going to be out for up to 2 weeks as well. And, that's going to mean more time for Anderson Varejão, who has not looked good so far this year. But we'll see. Maybe this will be a good chance for the Cavs to kind of figure out whether he is going to actually be able to contribute at all this year.
Yeah, it'll definitely be a kind of a notable stretch for them, just like it'll be for the Raptors without Valanciunas.
Yeah, and then the Warriors, per our buddy Sam Amick, still unsure of when Steve Kerr will return. I guess that doesn't really matter that much right now. I mean, Luka's been doing a few things that I disagreed with, not a ton. I mean, he's been playing. He played Spates and James Michael McAdoo at the four, which is just a disaster with either of those guys on both ends. Both those guys are fives, especially in their system. And he also had been reticent to use the death lineup, but I think we're over with that now. He's going to use that whenever he needs to, I hope, regardless of whether post-Beast Brooke Lopez is on the other side or not.
Prediction, will they use that lineup at all on Tuesday?
Against the Lakers? Maybe if it's close for like the last like 2 minutes of the first half, but I think it'll be a blowout by the fourth quarter, and they will set the record. I'm not going to be there though, unfortunately. I'm traveling back to the Midwest, so you'll have to carry the podcast flag for us.
I will be happy to do that.
Yeah, it's too bad. I was on vacation for Clay's 37-point quarter last year, and now I'm going to miss them very likely setting the record. But
I've still never seen a guy score 50 in person, despite covering the NBA for 7 years.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you missed the Curry's game against the Mavs last year.
Correct.
When are they going to lose? What's your prediction?
I actually think they might lose against the Suns.
I was thinking that too. I think they're either against the Suns or the Jazz. It's going to happen.
Yeah, I think it would be amazing if they could finish that. They have a crazy long road trip, but I think that they might just, because not only is the Suns game, you know, it's right after they would have set the record by themselves, but it's also on the front end of a back-to-back on the road, so it's kind of that weird dynamic, and they're about to go on a road trip right after that. So it has the kind of all the trappings of a trap game, and so I think there's a possibility there. The Suns have also had some good games, and Bledsoe, I think Bledsoe has the kind of the right physical makeup to make life hard on Curry.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's probably more likely that it happens against the Jazz. But, yeah, I think Phoenix is a possibility. I'd be surprised if they got past the Jazz. And then on that road trip, they're at Charlotte, at Toronto, at Brooklyn on a back-to-back, at Indiana, a game that I will be at. then at Boston and at Milwaukee. So I think very unlikely that they make it through all of those games unscathed. I mean, it's very unlikely that any NBA team makes it through, you know, 8 games unscathed, but they're actually playing some pretty good teams on that trip.
Yeah.
All right. We about done here. Anything to plug before we go?
Yeah. Mondays are when my League Pass Alert column comes out on the Sporting News and Warriors Weekly comes out on Warriors World. So both of those will be live when you guys probably listen to this.
Awesome. If you want to follow Danny on Twitter, he is Danny LaRue. I am Nate Duncan NBA. Also, our Facebook pages at Nate Duncan NBA and Danny LaRue NBA. Great ways to keep up with our various writings. Also, using that cap space code on DraftKings is a great way to support the program and help pay for my new podcast studio, where the audio quality is going to be very, very slightly improved. Also, an iTunes review or rating is extremely helpful, and that's been instrumental in our success. And we thank everyone who's done that. People said some fantastic things that have, I think, warmed both of our hearts to hear. So now that I'm done being sappy, we will talk to you all next time.